I'm Kai Von Troff, a Democratic political commentator and public interest attorney, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. And on this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with political commentator and public interest attorney, Kai Von Troff. Stay tuned. Once again, thank you for listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing and sharing it with your friends and family, and for following us everywhere on social media. If you're enjoying these episodes, please also take a moment to submit a kind rating and review wherever you might be listening or watching, as it's very much appreciated. Now, no matter where you live, politics and policy relate back to nearly every aspect of our lives, from our businesses to our societal structures to the content that we consume. Now, lately, and especially as election cycles ramp up again, the dialogue and commentary that are generated by our political figures and those running for office range from the contrasts of being educational and maybe entertaining to provocative and maybe even problematic. Last month, during the first Republican debate here in the US, there were two Indian Americans taking center stage, leaving me with many, many mixed feelings related to those contrasts. So, hoping to get the perspective of someone who kind of lives in this world, I caught up with Democratic commentator, public interest attorney, and nonprofit advisor Kai Von Troff. Kai Von has a law and policy degree from Harvard and an MBA from Yale, and after working as a digital advisor on Hillary Clinton's campaign, he's been active as a Democratic organizer and senior advisor for the nonprofit Institute for Education. His online commentary and media analysis for the past several years have made him a well-sought-after and seasoned voice, even as he hasn't yet turned 30. We caught up to talk about a range of things, from political strategy and representation to centrism and identity. But we started out by chatting about this crazy ongoing political universe and how longevity can exist in a highly compressed and rapidly churning cable news cycle.
News cycle longevity is so compressed, right? I mean, like, it's impossible to sort of keep up with the amount of information that we have at our fingertips. And yet, people like Donald Trump, and by the way, full disclosure, I am a lifelong Democrat. I'm a hardcore centrist in that way. I really believe in and I'm grateful for all that President Biden, Vice President Harris are doing. Yet with this news cycle longevity that's so compressed, people like Donald Trump, seemingly with an indictment every couple of days happening, you know, they seem to have longevity. They seem to have staying power. And what actually fuels that? What does it say about our appetite for information like this? And, you know, to some degree, what does it say sort of about the state of affairs of people then in that way, sort of like trying to have faith in things?
I think it's a really interesting question because to some extent, we want to say, well, this is what the American people obviously want and we reward and we pay attention to. But I think if you really sort of are immersed in the media and that space, you start to understand just how top down so much of this is. Because, for example, you know, yesterday I was tweeting sort of, you know, petty, but, you know, Mehdi Hasan and Chris Hayes are bashing Democrats like, hey, why aren't you hammering the messaging on the Inflation Reduction Act being so successful after 1 year? And it's no joke, but literally Biden gave an extended speech to deliver that message. And what happens? MSNBC cuts away from the speech. So yeah. It's like, you know, it's constantly Dems are bad at messaging, Dems are bad at messaging. But there's also, I do think, an absolute bias for, you know, institutional corporate legacy media towards the conservative, because frankly, that's their audience. Who's watching cable news? Who's reading the Wall Street Journal? So part of it's a business model. And part of it is these power players that own these entities do have a political agenda to some extent. You know, sure. It's not every outlet. So I think that's part of the problem. Another part of the problem is take the indictments, for example, right?
Yeah.
I think simple messaging around 4 different indictments across multiple jurisdictions for crimes that, you know, the American people are not necessarily familiar with. You know, I am an attorney and keeping track of all the different, you know, counts and who's like leading what charge, yeah, right?
It's staggering, right?
To do, and it's hard to process, and it's certainly hard to communicate the importance of and the gravity of, whereas Trump's just going to say the same thing over and over again. Republicans are just going to, as we've seen for the last, you know, several years, and it'll continue through the election, they'll just say Hunter Biden every single day, yeah, no matter what. And so that's easy. That's easy to communicate. And I think that, yes, we do have to be better communicators, because building trust, you know, to your point, is critical. That's number one. And communication is, you know, the key to that. At the same time, I do think it's not a double standard. It's a different project that Democrats have, because they want to have honest, informed conversations about some of these topics and issues. And yet that does come at the cost of sort of immediate short-term communications impact. So
yeah, and in thinking about that, right? I mean, like, you know, we're both kind of in the same sphere. We're both Democrats. We in many ways share that. And I'm fiercely a centrist, and not just because that's sort of my ideology, but I think it's actually good for politics. I think it's good for governing, it's good for collaborating. At the end, right, whether they're media forces, whether there are our interest in, you know, kind of what's hot out there, it does lend to a lot of kind of tribalism and echo chambers and drawing lines in the sand. And they seem to make, therefore, collaborating and building bridges that much harder. How do you reflect on this? Or even sort of what advice do you have for someone like me who really, really does want to, you know, actually listen and be in that sort of, you know, center, so that I can in many ways be an effective builder of bridges and collaborator and find out what's going to actually move us forward, as opposed to staying on the edges outside of those kind of demarcated lines. And by the way, I hope that makes sense.
It certainly does. I think, though, I first probably have a question for you, which is, how would you even define being a centrist? And I ask that because I feel like I used to be much more moderate, you know, like in high school.
Not that, right.
You know, your political opinions are super formed back then. But, you know, I kind of used to have that view. And I think it's sort of a predominant American, like, sort of capitalist type view of, like, you know, the center's a good place and that's all good. Let's all come together and build things together and move forward and growth and everything like that. I think today, the jig on that's a little bit up, because Republicans have realized, right, like Elon Musk identifies as a centrist, and to me that's laughable because he's like a far right, you know, guy. But I do think, you know, we sort of buy into that. It's like, no matter what, you can say you're a centrist and, you know, you sound reasonable. And also, the right has been moved so far right that the center is now really to the right and not really a platform. There's no values behind it. It's kind of just like, you know, positioning to me that I think has some value to it, but I think, where do we want to be in the center of? So I'm just honestly—
It's a good question. And to be honest, I think it's an important one, right? Because I very much lean left. I very much am socially conscious of inclusion. I'm very much economically conscious of equity. I want things to be fair. I want everyone to have a fair pathway, but I'm also willing to listen. Right. So, I mean, like, I want to, and maybe centrist is not the right way to, maybe I am as diehard left as it gets. I don't know. But, and maybe that's part of the issue, right? Like, I mean, I'm someone who wants to listen. I want to actually be open to collaboration and building bridges and making sure that progress can happen, as opposed to the absolutes where things are just so black and white and they're just so like binary to, you know, really cut people off from conversation in some way. So I don't know, like, whether or not centrist or moderate, however way we want to define it, I know where my heart is. I know where my compass is, so to speak.
Yeah, I think like two things on that. So one, I kind of think like also this idea of tribalism, certainly data shows that America is more polarized than ever, but I kind of reject the premise a little bit, because I do feel like one political party is being led essentially by this MAGA cult. And that is truly a tribe.
Yeah.
On the other hand, though, when you see this Hunter Biden news break, at least, you know, people like me who are like solidly Team Biden, you know, are not saying what the Republicans would be saying in that similar situation. You know, we're saying thank you, Joe Biden, for keeping this process independent. This is unfortunate. Now, does that mean we're not going to draw distinctions and say Hunter Biden was a private citizen, Ivanka Trump was super unethical and given a, you know, official position by her dad that she was unqualified for, that she exploited with her husband to make hundreds of millions of dollars? You know, yes. So I think, you know, I don't necessarily buy into the everybody's so tribal thing right now. I think what's happening is people on the left too feel so much is at stake that the silly little nonsense, you know, on the fringe, I think people have less and less time for. And so I think, to me, when people want to constantly tell you, well, you got to understand the other side, you got to understand, and people constantly tell me, oh, well, you live in a bubble, you got to, why don't you go talk to people and understand why, you know, Republicans are against student loan forgiveness. I actually do understand, you know, I have listened to the people. I disagree with what they're saying and their arguments. So I'm allowed to, at some point, say, I've done the research, I've had the conversations, I've listened to people, and now I've come up with my own ideas and thinking around it. And then I don't need to, yes, if new information is going to be available, sure, but I don't need to keep listening to the same talking point I disagree with over and over and over again. So I think that there is a little bit of that at play. And an example, again, is, you know, RFK Jr., who I think is a very sort of damaging person to have a platform. And and I think that's okay, because if you've never heard of the guy, sure, you can be curious, you can be interested. But if you're actually interested, here's what you would do. You would go inform yourself. You would watch the news. You would follow the several things of, you know, him, you know, engaging in some anti-Semitism, the anti-vax. If there's just a whole laundry list that once you have informed yourself, then you don't need to continue to have an open mind because you know information that you could actually, you know, synthesize. Yeah. And I think, so I think a lot of the tools that hold our democracy back are these kind of ideas that we need to both sides everything and we need to like kind of kumbaya at some point. I mean, there really is a group of anti-democracy insurgents here that are part of the opposing political party, and they don't want to work with us. They don't want some of us to exist, you know?
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is that like part of the main reason I was so attracted to President Biden was his ability to listen, his ability to evoke compromise. And I feel like the power that he has to do that in a very steadfast way has been really compelling. And I am grateful for that. And, you know, maybe as someone who serves as a public interest attorney can speak to this, right? Is it important to have more voices present, right? Is it important to have competitors in this space? Is it important for President Biden to actually debate other nominees, for that matter? I don't necessarily feel it is, but I'm just curious what you have to say about that. Do the Cornell Wests need to be on a stage with him?
An old professor of mine, actually. No, I think absolutely not. You know, somebody like Cornel West, and I think this also just speaks to our media ecosystem again, he's a thoughtful guy. I respect him. I totally disagree with his approach. I don't think his presence in this race is productive. I disagree with his ideas as well. But I think, you know, he's an important voice in the American discourse. And he's somebody who, like a lot of academics sort of in the later chapter in life, is desperate to get his ideas out there. And so I think the way that running for president works these days is it's kind of a free press tour. Now, don't think that's helpful to the country.
Yeah.
On Biden, you know, incumbent presidents don't have primary debates and they don't have primaries because that's not the power and advantage of being an incumbent is incredible. It's like the number one advantage you can have, especially if you have been doing a good job, you know, on the economy, which Biden has been doing. So why would we, you know, kind of do an own goal like that? And frankly, it's not even an own goal because Cornel West is not part of the Democratic Party. RFK Jr. is not part of the Democratic Party. Marianne Williamson does not deserve to be on the debate stage with Joe Biden. These are all sort of, you know, kind of hucksters who want attention. And unfortunately, because a lot of the incentives around media are not substantive, they're going to reward that, but it's not good for our democracy. That's, I think, one of those examples where people constantly say, oh, well, conversation, competition, that's all really good for democracy. Not like in theory, yes, maybe in your like first year political science seminar in college, you all talked about that. But in the real world here, like, you know, putting a bunch of conspiracy theorists on stage with the president of the United States actually isn't productive for democracy. So I think, you know, a lot of these things, when you just dig a little deeper, the sort of, you know, current civility consensus doesn't really like hold up.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with political commentator Kaivon Shroff. Stay tuned.
Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Kaivon Shroff.
I want to pivot here real quick. I love the piece that you wrote for The Hill about legacy admissions, especially on the heels of that Supreme Court ruling prohibiting race-conscious college admissions. And one thing I read that you said was that the relevance of Ivy League plus schools is waning. I'm just curious, what do you think now, kind of going forward, what do you think that irrelevance and perhaps even the institutional erosion is going to look like in this new era of sort of redefining what merit is?
I think, you know, and I've spent a long time in spaces like that. And I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of good that comes out and the resources are incredible and the networks are incredible. But I think when you take a zoom out and you look at what the Ivy League has done to our American education system, just overall, the idea that only these 8 schools are, you know, or even call it 15, you know, if you want to include the sort of next tier, but that those are your chances at success or to make it in America doesn't make sense. That's not a model that's sustainable. And I think what we're seeing with the Varsity Blues scandal, right, where all the celebrities tried to buy their kids way into college, or even write this lawsuit in the Supreme Court over who gets admitted for what and how we define merit. I think we're starting to understand that, or, you know, a lot of people have understood this for a long time, but it really is a way to perpetuate class privilege in, you know, a way that I think just isn't serving the country and moreover is detached from merit. So if going to Harvard Law School doesn't actually make you a better lawyer than going to any other school, then why should you get a whole bunch of, you know, perks and credit? Like, just look at all the Harvard educated lawyers in the Trump administration that were in the Trump administration, or, you know, that are lying. Kayleigh McEnany, right? Harvard law grad, lying about the indictments, saying she's heard grand jury testimony, knowing full well that it's, you know, private. She certainly didn't hear that. So those types of things, I think, are what people are really going to start challenging. And that's not to say that education itself isn't valuable, but I think it's certainly the returns on education are not delivering. There's so many people I know from my class, I went to Brown for undergrad, struggling to have, you know, a job that a lot of my peers from high school that went to less sort of hoity-toity schools are not having a problem with. And I think it really depends about the goals people have for education. But I think, you know, certainly growing up for me, and obviously coming from an immigrant family, maybe had a part to do with that. But I think, you know, my parents were definitely not the pushers on education. The tools that people need to be successful and contribute to our society are not all, you know, going to be found at top liberal arts colleges. So I think we're seeing, you know, training schools and trade schools and sort of go level up and go learn for a year here. And then, you know, you can increase your salary by $20,000. Those types of programs are going to be much more available. Now, I think obviously, as we've seen with sort of different scams, and Trump University comes to mind, but, you know, vetting those different opportunities is important. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of vulnerable people trying to, you know, improve their lot in life and invest in themselves are getting tricked and scammed. So I think we haven't solved it yet. And certainly these schools will be somewhat relevant. Like, I don't think in 10 years, nobody's going to respect people for going to Harvard. At the same time, I think more and more people are hip to the idea that just because you went to Harvard doesn't mean you are going to be a genius.
and hopefully vice versa, right? That like, you know, going to community college and going to vocational school could spell enormous success in the future. And hopefully that merit sort of gets democratized.
Well, and I think, like, almost the reverse of it, right? It's like, just like we're saying about race conscious admissions, which really is multi-factor admissions where they're giving people credit for their context and what they've accomplished and overcome. If you go to a school with less resources and, you know, not a big city and like you're crushing it and you're killing it. And, you know, one of the smartest people from my business school class was the top kid at, you know, University of Buffalo. He beat out 20,000 people, you know, like that's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
So I think, you know, certainly people are kind of getting hip to this, and there is this elitism and sort of this counter elitism that I think has made people just feel so, and there's an antagonistic relationship, I think, with the American public and some of these colleges because of not only the exclusion, but I think there is this like perpetuation of privilege and power here that people see that doesn't, that isn't necessarily deserved.
I'm just curious, because I've asked this to other people before. I mean, aside from your name, are there anchors or even daily reminders about your identity that are perhaps, you know, important to you or that you discover are important to you?
I think no, and I'm going to give a corny answer that probably it's my family. I mean, my grandparents, I grew up with them all 5 minutes away from our house. So see them, I still see them, you know, at least once every 2 weeks. They either come into the city or I go see them. Three of them are still with us, fortunately. So I think that's probably my biggest reminder on a consistent basis.
Yeah.
But I think also my journey as an Indian American, I think is very different than even other people my age. My grandparents came here, and I think most of the peers that I grew up with that were also, you know, the same background, their parents had come here, so they were far more in touch with things like the Indian food that their families would cook at home. And I think a lot of different, you know, my mom was a working mom. She was certainly, you know, like, she was also a lawyer. So I think just like much more of a suburban kind of identity that I identify with, of having that working mom, and kind of just like, you know, yes, I was probably one of the only brown people in my class in a school growing up. So I certainly, you know, looking back has been really interesting. And I think so you do learn so much in college. And I think, you know, I've become so much more aware of different racial issues and even sort of, you know, on a micro level, how, you know, power and, you know, diversity really play such roles in every single thing that we've done. And I think if you go back and look at your childhood, it's really easy to kind of process things differently and say like, oh, wow, yeah, like I was the only brown kid in that class. Like now I see like some other thing. And I'm not saying those things, you know, didn't happen, and I don't, but I do try to be thoughtful about what my real experience at the time was.
For you now, when you see that there are, as someone who's an Indian American, has an Indian American background, but like you said, like, you know, you don't necessarily have the anchors and the daily reminders of it that you sort of identify with, and everyone's journey and everyone's, you know, pathway for that discovery of their identity and rediscovery of their identity is so different. As someone who's Indian American, and, you know, I'm curious how you feel about the fact that there are three Indian American background candidates on the Republican presidential nomination, you know, side, you know, how does that hit you in that same spirit of not necessarily identifying with this on a day-to-day basis, yet there is some connection, right? I mean, I guess is part of the idea of this podcast in the first place of that being a common thread.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, even just to build off your last question, and then I'll it connects to that. I think one daily reminder sort of is that I am a brown person in America at this time when I really do feel like there is, you know, a really big white supremacist movement, frankly, in, you know, that's been treated as like a credible political party. And we talk about as if it's super normal that, you know, a white nationalist like Trump should be the president again, and that all his supporters saying blatantly racist stuff to people like me, you know, obviously being active online, I certainly, you know, get a lot of trolls.
Get your fair share of that,
certainly. But I think what's so disappointing to see about those three candidates you mentioned on the Republican side is just how quickly they are willing to weaponize their minority identity to serve this kind of darker goal of being, you know, the token shield for this party that really is a racist, sexist party.
But I'm curious about this. I mean, you wrote that Vivek Ramaswamy is an, quote, an extraordinarily contrived figure who does not resonate with or represent Indian Americans, young voters, or young Indian Americans like me, unquote. And in your mind's eye, when you were actually watching that debate and then sort of the aftermath of, in many ways, kind of the follow-up and the follow-through from those debate moments, what were some of your gut reactions as a young Indian American, and particularly with using that word, those words of not resonating or not representing? I mean, what were some of those kind of gut visceral reactions for you, even in the moment, perhaps, as you were watching them?
Sure. So I think one of the main reactions and one of the pieces kind of touches on this is watching, and I want to go back to 2020 for a second, watching Andrew Yang, who I really think says a lot of irresponsible, poorly supported things, and really has kind of further gone into the weird since his like mainstream days, really did a disservice to this sort of burgeoning movement of really engaged, really progressive Asian Americans. And then I think with that in mind, kind of simultaneously, we now have quite a wide array of certain Asian American voices that it really demands that the media actually invest the resources and time in unpacking the Asian American sort of catch-all identity that I think really doesn't serve our communities, whether you're South Asian or, you know, Chinese, for example, is very different to the experience that you might have had in this country. And so my thought watching the debate was, wow, there really aren't that many young Indian American voices in this sort of national stage, right? There's Ro Khanna, there's certain members of Congress, et cetera. But I think not running for president. And then specifically, you look at people, you know, I talk to people all the time who are like, oh, what about Nikki Haley or Kamala Harris? And of course, we do have those figures. But I think as somebody that, you know, just is in the political space, the reality is a lot of people process Vice President Harris as a Black woman first for a whole lot of reasons, complicated reasons. And also she's from a prior generation. And then same with Nikki Haley, you know, she's quite a white passing person on appearance. And then I think she's really leaned in and out of her identity, mostly out of it until recently. So this is kind of a new thread of somebody who's going to be perceived as an Indian American who has their name, same, Vivek Ramaswamy. So, you know, credit for that, I gotta say. And I wanted to comment on the fact that I think a lot of people watching him for the first time who might be, you know, my colleagues from business school or, you know, something like that, who are inclined to believe that Indian Americans skew conservative and sort of do care about, you know, more sort of right-wing issues, and just correct the record on that. So I think that was just the first response, and just pointing at the data. And I think the comments and response I got to the pieces really made me think, oh, I'm glad I did this, because so many people commented saying, I'm surprised to learn this. I didn't know that over 70% of Indian Americans, you know, supported the Biden-Harris ticket going up to the 2020 election. I didn't know that, you know, I think more people knew this one, but, you know, young voters obviously are incredibly out of sync with the ideas and policies he's pushed forward. And so I think it was just important to call that out, particularly as he's on that debate stage. Two things, right? First, he opens up with that sort of stolen Barack Obama line or reference, right, about being, you know, the skinny kid with a funny name. And it really just kind of made me laugh in two ways, because I do think it gets to representation and the problem of representation that people like us and, you know, certainly young Indian Americans grew up with, which is, yeah, you know, Obama probably was one of the closest examples to representation at that level and in our history for somebody like me. You know, certainly there's major differences between being, you know, a Black person in America and a brown person in America, but there's also a lot of overlap, and, you know, with limited representation, that is who people look to. So I just thought it was funny that, you know, he sort of wants to be the antithesis of Obama, but yet that's still his hook and his frame that he sees, you know, his political world through.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like he clearly was trying to anchor himself in that same narrative. And here's someone who was not necessarily disavowing his identity. Here's someone who definitely was throwing himself into his name, throwing himself into being an Indian American, a Hindu American. And yet, I mean, so out of sync, perhaps, with what our community norm, at least politically and civically minded, has been. I mean, is there a kind of ripple effect that you think, even within our community, that this kind of representation, or for that matter, misrepresentation really has? especially when it comes to civic engagement and the perception of civic engagement going forward?
I think there's a ripple effect that goes in both directions, because what's really happening is we are seeing that our community is getting more politically engaged. And I did some reporting on this for The Juggernaut, which is an Indian American sort of focused, Desi, just generally focused publication. And it was after the election of Trump, a couple years after that most recent 2018 midterm cycle, where suddenly you had a slate of Asian American candidates running for office across the country. And I spoke to some of those candidates, and so many of them said that Donald Trump and his bringing back just such blatant xenophobia into the public discourse is what prompted them to run, what caused them to reflect on their own family's journey here. And I think in a way that Asian Americans, and particularly South Asians and Indian Americans, had been able to kind of avoid if they wanted to up until Trump, because of those model minority myths and sort of some other, you know, different factors. Starting with that Obama reference, right, shows just kind of the two polar opposites of representation. One is Obama resonated because he spoke to true experiences in his life, and he gave voice to a generation that felt that they were not being heard in the political sphere. Hearing, you know, the same talking point from an empty shell of a person who's, you know, kind of made his money off of this drug that he like pumped and dumped, who did sort of check all the boxes, right? He went to, you know, an elite law school like Obama. He, you know, is now running for president as a young minority, but he doesn't represent, you know, any of the experiences he actually had. He wants to rewrite history. And I think, you know, one great example of that is he likes to talk about how he went to public school until eighth grade before going to a super elite private school, which kind of is the relevant part there. But anyways, and he uses that to say there were a lot of Black people, maybe majority Black, in that school, and that any of those students, had they had a stable family home, a two-parent home, would have been able to achieve what he's achieved. And it's wrong for so many reasons. First of all, it's deeply rooted in anti-Black racism. This idea that he wants to sort of blame a crisis, quote unquote, of fatherlessness for achievement gaps between our community and the Black community in America is wrong and just needs to be called out. But I think then when you look at his own personal experience, not only did his family come over with certain privileges, but then on top of it, he did go to this elite private school. He then did get a scholarship, right? The New America P.D. Soros Scholarship targeted to new immigrant families. And so you can't look back on your life and say, oh, I think policies that, you know, try to prioritize diversity and inclusion are horrible, and actually it's those policies that are racist and problematic. Let's eliminate them all. And if you elect me, I will do that on day one, when your own life is the result of those exact same policies. And so it's just totally disingenuous. And this continued, as we've seen with Nikki Haley, and we've seen with Tim Scott and other minority voices in the Republican Party, this weaponization of identity.
I'm curious about one thing. I mean, what's not lost on anyone, I hope, is the political calculus here, right? I mean, here's someone who, you know, was up on stage, continues to be, and yet the political calculation must be that he is running against a front runner here in Trump that he has to try and overtake and overcome. Do you think that, unfortunately for him, is this all a political play? Or is there a dangerous ideology here that, for the most part, really, really doesn't win in a national election?
What I really think is that this is a person who had a lot of money, who saw a model that it was very easy to get media attention if you A, run for president, but especially if you B, are what's a surprising validator. And I'll dive into that concept in a second, but I will say, I think the most relevant thing is you have to be 35 years old to run for president of the United States. And this is the first election he can do it. I do not believe at all that this was a decision on a whim as he likes to portray it. I think this has been a long thought out, you know, plan and agenda, but anyways, back to this idea of the surprising validator. And so this is a concept that is really intuitive, but a former professor of mine, Cass Sunstein, behavioral economist, kind of coined this term, surprising validator. And the idea is that when somebody of an opposing group endorses or sort of parrots the talking points, ideas, facts of your own group, it has some sort of additional conversion power, persuasiveness, because ideally you think this party doesn't have an incentive to say something otherwise inconsistent with the overall slate of, you know, priorities, values, et cetera, of their group. The log cabin Republicans, a group of gay Republicans, you know, decades ago sort of was a popular version of this. Certainly the Lincoln Project has really made kind of both, you know, a name for themselves and some money off of this approach. And, you know, I think people can have a view either way, whether that's a good or bad thing. Maybe it's just the reality of our media and political ecosystem today. Yeah. But the reality is, whether you're Chris Christie too, all of these players understand that if I go on CNN and I say, you know, and I went on CNN with this exact type of person, right? If I'm the Republican, you know, Gen Zer, with who's a Black person who's going to say that I support the Florida slavery standards, teaching standards that say there were benefits to slavery, you're going to get a lot of airtime. You're going to get booked everywhere. You're going to get that media attention. And that is in itself an incentive and powerful for a lot of people. So I think we can't underestimate that dynamic, sort of these outlandish people who are willing to say the craziest thing that's the most surprising or unexpected. I don't know if that's, you know, ever going to be a model that gives productive information to people. And I think what you're seeing with Vivek, as he gets vetted and as he gets more and more attention, you know, I think right after the debate, people were like, wow, he really did great. He really understands the MAGA base. And he said he gave them the red meat and all this stuff. Yeah. And he said a bunch of crazy things. But then when he actually started to face some scrutiny and it started to get picked apart what he was saying, and he started to go on air and constantly say, I didn't say it. And, you know, even Fox News, even Sean Hannity's fact checking him, which is, you know, really a low point for you. It doesn't hold up. And he doesn't have the support that a Trump-like figure had, because at the end of the day, he's not playing in a party that wants to support somebody like him. So I don't think he can get away with what Trump got away with. And I think absolutely race is a factor, but also there's the other dynamic of Trump is like, if you're playing for the Trump audience, then you're either hoping that Trump goes to jail or dies or something like that, right? You have to, he has to be out of the competition for you to either be the nominee, or you're wasting your time and you just want attention. And some, you know, are arguing maybe he's trying to create a name for himself for 2028, all that stuff. I just think he's probably like, yeah, I'm gonna go get a bunch of attention. I'm super rich. I have these two little young kids, you know, I'm bored. Like, let me get out there. Let me say a bunch of crazy stuff. Because the reality is there's no way in hell that Trump is ever going to pick this guy for VP. Just think about it. I mean, Mike Pence was the perfect VP for somebody like Donald Trump, an absolute narcissist who has to have 100% of the attention and air in the room. Somebody like this, you know, Vivek guy who's like trying to have his own greatest hits and trying to like, you know, riff off of Trump's attention. I don't think that Trump is going to appreciate that. You know, right now he doesn't really have an incentive to go after him because he's getting a little media attention. Let's see how long it really lasts.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with political commentator Kaivon Shroff. Stay tuned.
Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sigda Sor, the founder and CEO of The Juggernaut, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Kaivon Shroff.
Let me ask you this. I mean, when you do have two Indian Americans, regardless of how much they are or aren't embracing that identity, when you do have those, you know, two Indian Americans, albeit from another party, who are taking center stage, engaged in the middle of a foreign policy discussion and debate in front of a very, very sizable national audience, is there any modest objective value to this? In the end, for, again, that global sort of representation question. Or the idea, of course, of, you know, our community is definitely present and engaged in that sort of civic discussion, because you do have two people there in the middle of that group having that conversation.
Yeah, well, I will say, you know, I do think it was a moment of just stepping back and taking it in, not necessarily in a good or bad way, but I, right, of course, noticed that the coverage from the debate, so many of the articles, the picture that you saw, right, was really a picture of Vivek Ramaswamy in the center of the stage and Nikki Haley right next, yeah, to him. And that was the photo they were running with of the GOP primary debate. So, right, absolutely an interesting moment. I think when you talk about representation, no, I don't think there's any sort of just objective value to having diverse faces that sort of lie about and misrepresent the realities of A, our world, B, their, right, own personal experiences, and C, the larger issues of race in the country for their sake. I do think it is offering this moment where, you know, you and I are talking about and unpacking the South Asian identity more, yeah, robustly. And I hope that it leads to more conversations like that all around, so that the great and diverse voices we do have sort of that actually do speak to and represent our community are being heard. But I think that, you know, we still have a bit to go on some of that.
And again, trying to think about two Indian Americans, again, regardless of how much they embrace that, having a discussion about foreign policy and Russia and, you know, Ukraine in a moment where, you know, again, the content is questionable, but the optics of it definitely can't be ignored.
Well, and I think one of the things that I think is most interesting, debate aside, after the debate, Ramaswamy put out a bunch of quote unquote myth busting, you know,
right,
things on his website. This is true, this is not true, et cetera. And in one of them, because of that debate moment, he went after Nikki Haley and he made sure to call her Namrata Rondawa. So, yeah, he's using, you know, first of all, an incorrect version of her birth first name. And then, like, a very clear sort of effort to, I think, other her, and at least to call out that she doesn't, you know, use her, the first name she was born with. She uses a middle name that was a childhood nickname. And I think on the one hand, sort of the authenticity piece, maybe that's a fair thing to call out that, hey, I'm Vivek Ramaswamy, I'm using, yeah, my name. And, you know, I think people have debated the appropriateness of whether, you know, it's very normal and standard that Nikki would go by Nikki, et cetera. It's a different, yeah, issue. But I just thought that that was such a pure example of how these folks, Nikki Haley at times too, are, yeah, weaponizing their identity, because then, of course, he gets called out for it. And what's the Ramaswamy campaign's response? Yeah. How on earth could he be making fun of her name? His name is Vivek Ramaswamy. And it's just such a see-through effort, right? This idea of, you know, weaponizing your own identity to bludgeon other minorities with it. And it's so obvious and transparent in that little sort of example, because who else could get away with that better than Vivek Ramaswamy of those GOP contenders? Nobody. One thing that I don't like to see, that I think has been a trend among minority millennials, is that they feel like their time has arrived and so they should run for office, but they can't actually connect it to what the intrinsic value of bringing youth and diversity are. Because if you, yeah, show up and you're boring and not engaging and you're whining and you're like feeling entitled to being elected to Congress or whatever the position may be, you're actually not bringing the new perspective and the youth and the energy that that is valuable, that we do need in those rooms and those places. But just because you check the box doesn't mean that you are actually serving that community in any way.
I read something you wrote about Suraj Patel, who was a guest, okay, you know, on the podcast.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that, like, you didn't necessarily vote for him, but you found that his third time running felt a lot more connected and authentic. And I don't think he actually performed as well the third time as he did maybe his second time.
He got Bloomberg's vote.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I guess, like, in thinking about this and thinking of someone who's analyzed this and has, you know, been very thoughtful about this, number one, I mean, have you ever entertained running for elected office? And then number two, as someone who is under 30 and yet is in this element of discourse, what is the secret then to engaging thoughtfully having a strategy, embracing your identity, and also winning.
Yeah. So I don't know.
It's a lot folded in there.
Love if he loved that article, but I think the point that I wanted to make was just the kind of what I said in the comment prior, and obviously you've really done your homework. So, but people understand we need to tap into diversity and young voices, but there hasn't been much vetting on that. Like, I do think, you know, for me, I just told you, you know, I'm not the most culturally plugged in person on the planet. I mean, I do have this little Indian thing my parents bought me.
Yeah, no, but you also got your Rolling Stone game going.
And I got
too,
right, so. exactly. Yeah. So to me, if I was going to run for office, right, I wouldn't be probably saying things, you know, that are more the cliche. I think it's great, by the way. If you think you can add value and make a difference and run for office, you should do it. And so to answer your question, like, it's crossed my mind. I think, you know, it is the type of thing that I would want to do if I felt like I could actually make an impact and a difference. I think, you know, what I'm focused on now is people love to, as we've talked about, you know, bash the Democratic messaging. And I do think that sometimes they are not necessarily hammering it home. So I think, you know, I hopefully am adding value in that space and learning as I go.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with political commentator Kaivon Shroff. Stay tuned.
Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Congressman Ro Khanna, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with political commentator and public interest attorney, Kaivon Shroff.
Back to another piece you wrote, because I really did enjoy this one. This was something that you wrote about that whole Kristen Bell Idaho dinner photo.
Oh, yeah.
and then, you know, I was thinking about this. You talk about sort of like the balance of demanding better and combating bigotry and, you know, combating disinformation and misinformation while avoiding being labeled as sort of like this, you know, overwoke cancel culture warrior, right? I mean, it is a fine line to sometimes, and a fine needle to thread, as you put it. Is this just simply impossible to do online? When there's, you know, there's often no texture. There's no deeper context. I mean, I had to read your article, right? I mean, like, I spent and invested the time to read it. I got a little bit more of a window. We're having a conversation right now, and it allows me to get context and understand more. But we don't do that often, right? We just don't actually dig deeper. We don't ask more questions. We're not getting more context or supporting these things. So how do you navigate that balance between, you know, making sure that, you know, we combat disinformation and bigotry, but also don't get labeled as you mentioned, these sort of, you know, overwoke cancel culture warriors?
Well, I think it is kind of the ultimate question is, what is your goal and what are you trying to accomplish? And I am trying to accomplish, to your point of, right, reaching out to people that don't necessarily agree to you. I have actually those people in mind. I am, you know, consistently putting out Democratic messages, but I do think that there are a lot of people that are moderate Republicans or, you know, friends of my parents and grandparents that I think I can have a conversation with and change their mind and convince them and sort of marshal the evidence in a way that I think is surprising to people and maybe they didn't know. And, you know, I think if you're not paying that much attention, it's really easy to kind of get the wrong takeaway from current stories. So I am trying to do that. And I kind of think of those people in my mind. And first of all, also it helps that a lot of them follow me. So I'm like, you know, am I really going to tweet something insane that my, like, you know, law school professor is following me right now? And
that's right.
Like, so that always helps as a little check. But I think, you know, there's a range for all sorts of voices. And I think what you have to do is communicate to even those, all of those voices that you can communicate to what the ultimate goal is. And I think AOC to me is a good example of this, because I think she probably started a little closer to that like extreme version of cancel culture warrior, you know, a caricature of the right's, you know, version of the worst thing possible from a Democrat. And I think if you actually look at how she's evolved over the past few years, she has a really good, they call it like, you know, sort of your publicity and all that stuff is like the outside game you have. And in Washington, how you're working with different lawmakers and your colleagues is the inside game. She has a really good inside game in addition to her incredible, you know, Instagram following and all that stuff. Because I think she's realized, right, like this, it is a little dirty and messy to get things done. And that is her goal. So I think just when you can show people that and you can be really clear about the process and share information, that is step one. So I think, you know, for example, somebody like Nancy Pelosi probably had a major role in communicating with the so-called squad and listening to them, not necessarily dismissing them sometimes and not always, you know, kumbaya, but ultimately winning them over because both groups realize they have a joint project. And I think as long as you can keep showing that and doing that, it's worth it. But you have to draw the line somewhere because it takes time and effort to win over people and build collaborations and coalitions. And we need to build a winning coalition, but also a coalition that stands for something. So I think, you know, one thing I really don't like about Bernie Sanders and sort of his kind of brand of candidate is I often feel they are willing to sacrifice, you know, on abortion rights, on other civil rights and social issues that to me, I think should be a non-starter. And we shouldn't be willing to say, you know, we're going to set aside abortion issues because that's controversial and divisive to, you know, this certain very specific white working class demographic that we're going to incessantly chase. Not saying don't go after those voters. I'm just saying if you can't win them over the right way, what do you really stand for? And like, why are we in this coalition trying to do these things? Because certainly some of this is fundamental and we can't compromise on.
Well, especially, I mean, like, you know, gun rights, climate, you know, these are, you know, additionally things like that. You know, when we think about the evolution of things, right, like AOC is a perhaps an example, but trying to basically apply balance. At the end, this is, you know, a lot about sort of like translating experience to developing, cultivating relationships. And I mean, your experiences have sort of taken you through law and policy and business and all those intersections, Senator Clinton's, you know, campaign, and now as a sort of commentary voice. What have you learned along the way about relationship development and particularly about cultivating trust?
I think what I've learned about relationships is so much more than the formal mentor you can get assigned or your boss that you're assigned or, you know, following sort of a tried and true path of how to succeed. What I have gotten the most out of is the one-off people, often older people, frankly, who are just interested. Like they're interested in young people. They're interested in, you know, I've had a really unconventional path and sometimes that's really helpful and sometimes it's a major roadblock. And so a big part of my story has been, you know, when I'm applying to jobs or something, I got to convince you that having a law degree and a policy degree and an MBA is actually a good thing. And it sounds like so obvious to some people that, oh, that's super impressive. But to a lot of people, you have to consider, they think like, okay, like, so what, do you really want to be doing this job for me right here? And things like that, right? But I think, you know, one mentor of mine, Coach Kathy Kemper is her name, and she's just an incredible, her story, I'll just tell you quickly, because I think it really captures how I feel about this. I met her at a dinner. I was working for Microsoft's civic tech team where they were collaborating with nonprofits in New York City, sort of as a, you know, corporate partner for different things. And we put on a dinner with this woman from DC, Coach Kathy Kemper. And she brings all these superstar people. And like, at first we're all a little confused because all we know about her is she's a tennis coach. Turns out she's a tennis coach. She was a tennis coach to Jimmy Carter and, you know, Hillary Clinton and John McCain, all these people. And 30 years ago, she decided that she was going to start a nonprofit to have bipartisan conversations and bring those groups together. And so she's done that for 30 years. And I graduated from business school at 23. And nobody wanted to give me an MBA, you know, level job because I was pretty young and I didn't have, you know, sort of the same level of work experience at, you know, a bank or something that other people had. But I met this woman and I had a lot of followers on social media and she was interested in that. And it was a trend and we kind of struck off a conversation and I pitched her and I was like, hey, you run this nonprofit where you literally have access to everyone on the planet. But at the time they were kind of putting on events. They had, Fox News anchor, who's now, you know, sort of Sir Ed Henry was his name. And he was giving a talk about his book on Jackie Robinson at the Thai embassy. And I was like, oh my God, like I can come add some like focus and like help streamline this, like what you're doing, which is amazing. And she was just willing to not only take that chance. And so I'm still involved with them today, Institute for Education, awesome organization, definitely check it out. But just somebody that has, and every, it's a skill set people have, because it's not just me that she's been a great mentor to, it's, she likes to cultivate young people. And it, certain professors of mine, same thing, they like to cultivate young people and they're not territorial about, you know, what's the right thing to say and do. And the worst professors I've ever had are the ones that are more interested in telling people how things are and what they should do than actually listening to their students. The best professors are the ones that are like, constantly taking, I have 50 data points in front of me right now, and I'm gonna have another 50, you know, next semester, and I'm gonna keep taking away new insights and applying that to my own work and being really in touch and updating. So I think that to me is not only the best way to build trust, it's the best way to build relationships. And I think honestly, people are overly obsessed with like having a lot of relationships and networking. I hate networking. I absolutely hate it. I honestly, I think I used to be really good at it. Even though I'm only 29, I already like don't have the patience for it because it's just at this stage in the game, it feels so disingenuous and so sort of canned all the time. And, you know, people now ask me for advice sometimes, and I try to just think about the terrible advice I've gotten and what's been good or bad. You know, I had a conversation the other day with someone in media, big deal, who was like, you talk too fast, which I am doing a little right now. You talk too fast. And also, did you know that people find it really off-putting to say that you went to Harvard? It's like, first of all, yes. Like, it's not the first time I ever heard that. But at the same time, right, like, what are you doing here? Why are you talking to me? Like, I'm calling you to ask you how I can advance in this industry that you're an expert in. Like, if you really think I've never been told those two things, I don't know, but it's certainly not why I'm calling you to get that feedback. And same, right? It's like if somebody's asking me for advice, I'm not gonna tell them, you know, move your resume title over 1/2 inch. It's like, why are you asking me? What can I tell you that's really true and valuable? And I hope it helps you. And I'm not gonna have an ego about if you disagree and you don't follow my advice. So,
well, hopefully value, mentoring, and ego, and all the different components of that are generating great relationships and trust, and certainly aiding you as you go forward. Evan, thank you so much for
joining
us.
Thanks for having this. This is like an awesome outlet. I was so excited to see it because, you know, there's not so many of what you're doing. So
yeah, no, and I mean, you know, just generating a lot of fun, and we hope we can invite you back and you'll join us again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks once again, Kaivan. And you can follow him on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, and Threads. Now I'm grateful to you for listening, and please don't forget to share Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with your friends and family, and to offer any kind review or rating wherever you're listening or watching. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.